So we're out of here at 25 after. It's actually been a while since I taught a 50-minute Monday, Wednesday, Friday, which I definitely do not like as well.
You post the slides that you use and lecture on.
These slides are already on my website.
Okay.
On the the colored menu.
Yeah.
There's a slideshows link.
All
right. Let me just tell you, since there's a lot of people who've never had me as an instructor, let me also tell you about my slideshows. You'll notice that they are almost entirely pictures, very little text. And that's because I want you to listen to what I'm saying, not rewrite what's already on the screen. It's really perplexes me why any student who has access to a slideshow already would write down the text of that slideshow when they can just print it out. But even if I tell you not to do that, if I give you a text slide, I can look out and see about 90% of the students are going to be writing what's on that screen instead of listening to me. So that's one reason I use pictures only. Another is that they're usually the most important thing for understanding the text in terms of supplementing what I say. Another reason, though, is it forces you to put into your own words and write down what I'm saying. And those things are going to store that information in one place in your brain. Reading it is going to store it into another part of your brain. Speaking it, when you try to give lectures on your own after you've studied those, will put it into still another part in your brain. The more places in your brain you can store this information, the more likely is that you'll be able to retrieve it from at least one of those places when it comes to the test time. Okay, so writing to begin with, rewriting and revising, those all are part of studying, part of actually making it permanent knowledge. But anyway, when it comes to taking notes, of course, I'm not going to police you, but I recommend doing things the old-fashioned way, which means writing on blank sheets. Don't print out the pictures of the slides and try to make little notes next to them. Unless that truly helps you, I think it's better to just write on college-ruled paper. But I've taken all the figure numbers off of this because you might not be using a certain book, the same edition or whatever, and I've given just slide numbers to each one. I'll always announce what slide number I'm on so you can follow at home. And I recommend writing that slide number on your notes each time I change, write the new slide number so you can know where you were when you make sense of your notes at home. Before we actually get to the stuff that's in this first slide, let's just talk about organisms. What is an organism? Yeah. That's right. An organism is something that is made up of at least one cell. That is an absolute requirement for being an organism, which is why a virus, for instance, is not an organism. A virus isn't really alive, right? It's a biotic particle. It has to do with living things, but it doesn't have its own metabolism. It doesn't fulfill the seven or so major things that we categorize life by. Life really is not an easy thing to define. Usually what we say is that living things do this, 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 and this, right? They use energy, they reproduce, things like that. It's not a real neat definition for a dictionary, though. Well, viruses don't do that. Only things with cells do that. Only things with cells have metabolism. What is metabolism?
Energy
is involved in metabolism. It doesn't really create energy. Actually, energy is never created or destroyed, right? But even when I say, okay, I'll give you create energy, even though it's not strictly speaking creating the energy. That would only be one half of, or one part of metabolism. Yeah.
It takes in polymers, breaks them down, turns them into monomers, and rebuilds them, kind of catabolic and anabolic.
Yeah, there are two major subdivisions of metabolism, that's right. Anabolism and catabolism. But before we get to the distinction between those, what is metabolism? There's a simpler definition of metabolism. Yes, metabolism is the sum of all the chemical reactions occurring in the cells of an organism. And this really, not only is that just an important definition, but it's important because it points out that life really is just chemistry. Life is the chemical reactions that are occurring within cells. And more specifically, it's aqueous solution chemistry. That's what life is specifically. Meaning that it's these chemical reactions that make up life are occurring in solution, and more specifically, that the solvent of that solution is water. That's what I mean by aqueous solution chemistry. So not all chemical reactions are like that, but life's chemical reactions are like that. That's what makes the cell so fundamental. The cell is the fundamental unit of life, the functional unit of life. You have to have at least one of those cells to actually metabolize, because in order for those thousands of different chemical reactions to occur, which is just in one cell, thousands of reactions, in order for those reactions to occur properly, they have to be isolated from the surroundings. And that's what a cell does. That's how life began. When chemical reactions occurring in aqueous solution got sequestered or separated from the surroundings. And what is it that does that separation and that defines the cell? The cell membrane or plasma membrane, which is really what defines a cell, right? Every cell that's ever existed, including that cell that we all come from, not all humans only, but all organisms alive today, all come from an original cell. All cells along the way have had a plasma membrane. Now, not all plasma membranes are identical, but all cells have a plasma membrane. This opening slide just gives you an appreciation, if you don't already have one, of the fact that not all cells are just these little spheres, which we tend to think of it, you know, and many are. Many cells are just little roughly spherical bags. There can be quite elaborate shapes, especially in protists. Protists have the most elaborate shaped cells of any taxa. But no matter what shape it is, a cell has a plasma membrane, which is the boundary between what's ever contained in that cell and everything else. And so a cell acts a lot like a little test tube, right? A test tube can have isolated chemical reactions occurring in it. That's what cells accomplish. They separate that little piece of aqueous solution from everything else, and therefore they can be doing their own thing. And that own thing, collectively, is metabolism. Now, you want to distinguish between anabolism and catabolism?
Metabolism is the process of something coming and being broken down.
Which one is broken down? Is breaking down?
Catabolism.
Yes, catabolism is breaking big things into smaller things. And almost always that releases energy. Anabolism is just the opposite. So these are non-overlapping or mutually exclusive subsets of metabolism. Metabolism is all the reactions. The catabolic reactions break things down into smaller things. Anabolism builds things up from smaller things. And so that's what living things really do. They get some sort of energy from nutrients, and they get that energy by breaking those nutrients into smaller chunks, which they then can use those smaller chunks as raw materials for building bigger molecules once in reverse, basically. So you catabolically extract energy from food, you anabolically build up the components of your cells so that you can live. And that's your whole life in a nutshell. But this just shows you that there's quite a variety of cell sizes. Now, I'll talk about that in a different chapter. Let's go on to slide 2 and look at this woven, these three strands that are woven together. What this is trying to represent is that cell biology as a sub-discipline of biology is really itself a synthesis or a combination of three disciplines historically. And those three disciplines are cytology, biochemistry, and genetics. And I've listed those in order of age of those disciplines. So cytology is the oldest of these disciplines. Notice the broken line here. Hundreds of years ago, when the first microscopes were devised, that's basically when cytology was created as a discipline. Cytology literally means the study of cells, right? So you would think cell biology and cytology are synonymous, and they're kind of used synonymously nowadays, but historically speaking, cytology referred to basically descriptive anatomy, describing the structures of cells by actually looking at them with microscopes. And that's still important. But it doesn't tell us how things work, right? How the cells metabolize, how they reproduce. Biochemistry was the first of these strands to actually care about physiology. The difference, of course, is that anatomy has to do with structure. Physiology has to do with function, right? And so biochemistry took a look at the actual chemical reactions occurring in cells, what these things were accomplishing, and how they themselves were accomplished. And we've learned a hell of a lot from biochemistry, and continue to learn, of course. Genetics is the most recent in terms of creation of these three disciplines that synthesize into cell biology. And genetics started with whom? Gregor Mendel, correct, who did really good work that wasn't appreciated until he died, about 3.5 decades after he published his very careful work, the results from his very careful work. It was finally appreciated. But he had a lot of things figured out without having any idea what a gene is. And, you know, we still talk about Mendelian inheritance in his honor. It still works the way he said it works. He just didn't know molecularly why it was happening, but he had it pretty well figured out. So anyway, these are woven into the overall discipline of cell biology. Biology itself is a huge science, of course. There's no such thing as a biologist anymore. You know, the biologist used to mean someone who knows everything there is to know about biology at that point. And it used to be possible to know everything. I don't mean know everything that... be aware of everything that was known at the time is what I mean. It used to be possible to do that. Now, it's ridiculous to even think about that, right? So, a biologist is really someone who specializes in some tiny corner of biology. Cell biology is a corner of biology, but it's not even a little corner. You can get much more specific than just cell biology. Okay, well, let's talk about sizes of cells. This is slide 3. And notice that there's a plant cell and an animal cell shown here at the top. Before we talk about the sizes, let's talk about the dichotomy of cell types. What's a dichotomy? Yeah, it's two ways of thinking. It's a two-way classification, basically. So there are two major categories of cells. What are those two? Prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells, correct. They share that root karyo, right? Actually, it's karyon originally. Anyone know what that means? It means kernel, literally, yes. The kernel of a cell specifically refers to the nucleus, right? And so prokaryotic cells are so named because they evolved before a nucleus. In other words, they don't have a nucleus. Whereas a eukaryote, what does the EU mean? True. They have a true nucleus. Now, what makes a nucleus a true nucleus? Yeah. Yes, a nuclear envelope, which means that that qualifies a nucleus not only as an organelle, but a membrane-bounded organelle. Okay? I should also tell you that the two phrases, membrane-bounded and membrane-bound, do not mean the same thing. Okay? Membrane-bounded means having a boundary made out of membrane. In other words, it means membrane enclosed. Membrane-bound means bound or tied to a membrane. So, for instance, you can talk about a membrane-bound protein, which is just part of a membrane because it's stuck to that membrane. It's bound to it. The nucleus, on the other hand, is membrane-bounded because its boundary is formed by membrane. All right? Well, this is really, even though the etymological distinction between the words prokaryote and eukaryote is based on the absence or presence of a nucleus, it's not just the nucleus that matters. A prokaryotic cell doesn't have membrane-bounded organelles of any type, including the nucleus. Whereas a eukaryotic cell has membrane-bounded organelles. All right? So that's a fundamental distinction just based on the presence of those compartments. A prokaryotic cell is not compartmentalized because it just has that plasma membrane. Now, it can be almost as though it were compartmentalized by folding that membrane back and forth a lot of times, which happens in photosynthetic bacteria, for instance. But there's really just one compartment in a prokaryotic cell. And all of that stuff taking up that compartment is referred to as what collectively? Not all of it, just part of it is. Everything, all the stuff that's inside the plasma membrane of a prokaryotic cell together is called what? The cytoplasm, right. There is just that one compartment. A eukaryotic cell, on the other hand, is compartmentalized. So it has a cytoplasm, but the cytoplasm is all of the stuff that's inside the cell but outside all of the membrane-bounded organelles. So the stuff, for instance, in the nucleus is called the nucleoplasm, which is distinct from the cytoplasm. They're both aqueous solutions, but in a sense, the nucleus is kind of like a cell within a cell. The chemistry of those two aqueous solutions, nucleoplasm and cytoplasm, isn't the same, necessarily. The contents of them isn't the same. There's a different set of proteins and other macromolecules in those two compartments. So a eukaryotic cell by being compartmentalized, can have several different metabolic functions specialized by these different compartments, whereas a prokaryotic cell has to do it all in one compartment. All right? This is not a phylogenetic distinction, though. There are two types of cells based just on those membranes. But when it comes to phylogeny, true classification of organisms, we lump them into three groups, right? What am I talking about? What are these groups called? They are the domains, which are currently the biggest, most inclusive taxa. And what are the three domains? We'll end there. Right. Eukarya, bacteria, and archaea. It's easy to guess what the domain bacteria includes. All of the bacteria. Archaea, though, are very similar in some respects, or just from the point of view of someone looking at them only, very similar to bacteria. They do not have membrane-bounded organelles either. So the prokaryotes of the world are spread out into two of the life's three domains. Okay? There is no domain prokarya. All of the eukaryotic organisms, us included, are in eukarya. The prokaryotes are either in bacteria or archaea. I have to stop there.